States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On this week's show, we hear from Jeremy Steinberg, who has a training tip later on in the program. And first of all, we're going to be hearing from Senior Judge David Schmutz, who's going to be talking to us about para-equestrian. But before we get to that, we have one item of news this week, and that is that the USDF would like to congratulate the 13-year-old 17-hand Westphalian gelding Legolas 92, owned by Akiko Yamazaki's Four Winds Farm LLC and ridden by Stefan Peters of San Diego, California, for being named the 2015 Adequan USDF Grand Prix Horse of the Year. Legolas was recognized at the 2015 Adequan USDF Salute Gala and Annual Awards Banquet. Also, Legolas is the recipient of the Colonel Thackeray Award and will have his name engraved on a silver trophy to be on permanent display in the Rumor Foundation USDF Hall of Fame. At the USEF Dressage National Championships, Christina Vinius and Folkestone OLD earned national championship title in the Intermediaire 1 division, while Shelley Francis and Patricia Stemples Rubinio took reserve national champion honours. In the Grand Prix division, Laura Graves and Vadadis earned Laura her first national title. Stefan and Legolas 92 took reserve national champion title. In the December-January edition of the USDF Connection magazine, the judges' box this time features an article entitled Get Started in Para-Equestrian Dressage. The authors are Joanne Benjamin of Sherman Oaks, California, who is an FEI Level Para 2 judge classifier and a member of the USEF Para-Equestrian Technical and Adaptive Sports Committee, and David Schmutz of Glendale, California, who is an FEI 4-star para-equestrian dressage judge, a USEF S dressage judge, and a member of the USDF Judges Committee. And he joins me now to tell us more about this article. David, welcome to the program.
Well, good afternoon, Chris. Nice to talk to you.
Well, it is a subject that obviously is very dear to your heart, isn't it? And I'm sure the question pops up regularly as to how to get into para-equestrian dressage.
Well, this is a very good question to ask, and this is part of the reason that we put the article together, to try to encourage people who qualify to compete in the para-equestrian to be able to find the mechanism by which they can get into the sport, by which they can obtain a proper classification, either from FEI or from United States Equestrian Association Federation with a dispensation certificate. Either way, we want to encourage people who are disabled to be able to compete if they would like to do so.
So what would be the first steps? They would obviously consider the disability they have, which can change, of course, but where would they go to first?
What I would do first is to try to contact one of the classifiers here in the United States and have them do an evaluation. I know that people like Joanne, who is probably one of our best classifiers in the United States, is very, very happy to talk to people and to give them kind of a cursory look and kind of advise them as to where she thinks their disability would place them. And this would allow them to either go for a USEF dispensation certificate, which would allow them to compete nationally, which is really kind of the first step in doing competitive para-equestrian, or to go ahead and do the full classification process, which is done by not only a United States classifier, but also a foreign classifier, to agree on the disability and to make the placement in the proper grade.
Now, this disability that they may have can be pretty much anything, David, isn't it? I mean, it does range from, you know, a variety of physical disabilities to maybe mental disabilities.
Well, not necessarily mental disabilities. Most of these are physically grounded, such as the loss of use of one or more limbs, paralysis, blindness, but things like deafness and autism are not considered within that system. Most of the people who have these problems tend to be able to compete with the fully functional riders at a regular competition.
And does that also affect visually impaired, David? Is that also
very much so? There are people who are impaired, and what usually happens with them is if they decide to go with a classification which addresses that, in order to make it a completely level playing field, most blind riders have got to wear glasses or something to completely shut out the any ability to see in order to compete equally with other riders who are similarly disabled. If they do not want to choose that disability and want to ride without any sort of blocking the eyesight, that can be done too by simply not declaring that or having that show as a disability which needs to be recognized on their classification.
Explain to us the different grades, David, because a lot of us will see them written down, but are not quite sure exactly what it means to be graded and how that applies in a broad sense. I'm sure you can't include everything, but roughly.
Right. The ranges everywhere. There are five grades, and these go from a 1A, which is the most disabled, 1B, a little less disabled than that, all the way up to grade 4, in which the disability is not as severe, and the demands of each of the tests that are written by FEI are gradated within that grade system. Grade 1A, for example, in the mandatory tests, do have only walk work. But it has to be walk work at a certain quality. It has to be a walk which is a true medium walk, which means that there has to be connection. It's a fairly demanding test given that rider's disability. These are riders that are usually limited in either two or more limbs, have a paralysis. These are the most disabled people. And then, of course, the gradations are modified as you move up the scale until you get to grade 4, which is the least disabled of the grades.
Now, this is not to say that if you have a disability, you can't compete also in able-bodied classes as well.
Absolutely right. And of course, this is where the U.S. Equestrian Dispensation Certificate comes in, which allows you to compete on a more even field with able-bodied riders with approved compensating aids. And by compensating aids, I mean things like looped reins, which allowed people who have problems with their hands to be able to maintain a better contact. These are all allowed, but they have to appear as approved compensating aids that would be on a dispensation certificate. Those certificates have to be submitted in advance to competition management for any regular dressage competition, and then the judge would also have a copy of that dispensation certificate to allow any unusual aids that a rider would request in order to compete.
And I'm sure the first question is going to be from anyone who wants to become classified is what the costs would be and the process in terms of that initial evaluation before they can begin a competitive career.
It varies. I think that what you have to do is to go either to a classifier or a physical therapist who can then support an application for a dispensation certificate to U.S. Equestrian. The actual dispensation certificate, I'm not sure what the actual cost of that, probably around $100. But then you have to be able to produce the documentation and an opinion by a physical therapist, or even better, an FEI classifier, which would allow the Federation to be able to allow those compensating aids. It is not a terrifically expensive process to do either that or to go to an FEI show and to get your classification. You would simply have to be able to show up and work with the classifiers to be able to obtain their judgment on your grade, and of course, any FEI classification and documentation from the FEI website, once that occurs, is perfectly acceptable at a national show.
And if anyone is listening who hadn't considered doing this before, they should know that there is a range of opportunities right across national level and international level, all the way up to World Championships, of course, and Paralympics as well. So there are no boundaries within the sport, are there, in terms of access and progress?
There really are not, and I think that the only limitation are the riders, which is why Joanne and I decided to put this article together to try to make it a little bit more clear to the riders that would like to be able to go through this process and to encourage more riders who would like to be able to get themselves ready for this sort of competition. We're hoping, hopefully next year, that there will be shows in the United States that will be approved to go at a national level that will be just paraequestrian shows and will not necessarily need to be with a dressage competition. This would allow people who are interested in acquiring the skills to ride these tests to do so at a national level and to be able to become more proficient that way before they make the decision to go on and compete internationally, which of course is a much more expensive and much more demanding process.
And of course, whenever you open new doors, you may not lack, you may not have the confidence, you may lack a little bit of self-belief in a new venture such as this to be competitive. What would you say to those riders who haven't tried this before, David, and just a little bit shy of the process?
Well, I think that it has to be something that each rider would like to be able to do. Not everybody wants to do competition, but if a rider does have that as a goal and has a real drive to be able to do that, here's the way that this can happen. And I think that there are any number of people who are in the paraequestrian realm, not only the classifiers, but judges and organizers, who are wonderful resources. You have places like the Carlisle Academy over in Maine. You have places like Ride On in California that have very, very knowledgeable people. So people who want to be able to participate in this sort of competition can go to these sorts of resources to obtain the knowledge and the encouragement to be able to proceed and to compete if that's what they'd like to do.
And also we should mention the opportunities to watch other riders who are already in the sport, and they can go to competitions and watch them at shows and maybe introduce themselves. That's always a way, isn't it, to feel like you're welcome in a new environment.
Very much so, and I think that to see other riders at these international competitions, for example, is a wonderful and inspirational way to decide whether or not this sort of competition is for them. There are two competitions in January in Florida, which would be wonderful venues for people who are looking at possibly participating in this sport. Also, I understand that it's been recently announced that at Waterloo Hunt, just outside of Detroit, Michigan, there will be a national championship for paraequestrian, which will occur at the beginning of June of this coming year. So we have a number of places where people can show up and watch some of the best in our country compete and watch what the art of the possible is. That inspiration might encourage them to go and participate themselves.
And hopefully they will follow those chosen riders who go all the way to the Rio Paralympics in 2016, David. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the program and explaining this to us. And again, you can read David and Joanne's article in the December-January edition of USDF Connection magazine under the Judges Box column. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Chris.
And now, in our first education segment of 2016, we're joined by rider, trainer, coach, and clinician Jeremy Steinberg, who has a tip on starting your horse.
You know, with the babies, when it comes to getting them started under saddle, I think the first thing is just some really good basic handling, which, they should have had at this point, just as foals and yearling, just kind of getting acclimatized to people. And most of us, with the breeders in the U.S., we're pretty good about that, about making sure they're handled and get their feet done and all of that. When it comes to actually just starting them at first, as far as the work goes for looking to getting them under saddle. I think the biggest couple of things to keep in mind is just not to be in a rush. I say that a lot about young horses. The young horses are not necessarily more dangerous than advanced horses or more settled horses with their work, ones that have been under saddle for a few years, as long as we're willing to really take the time and be patient with educating them and getting them started correctly. The only time I really look at young horses and think they're unsafe is a time when I think they've been rushed or kind of brought along through the training a little bit too quickly and too fast with the initial work. I think one of the most important things with young horses is to really get them settled on a lunge line, preferably in a round pen. I know people do it a lot of times without a round pen. They'll do them sometimes just loose in a small arena with side reins on. But I find the actual round pen work, a large enough round pen where they're not on a super tight circle, but one where they have a wall, they have guidance, they have a small area for a mental and visual focus, and can really stay contained without a lot of outward force having to be applied to them to give them more to think about or stress about. So I think the round pen is really the place to start with it. I tend to just get them even on a halter and a lunge line just for a day or two, making sure they understand the concepts of, going around me both directions, because after being handled a bit, we always tend to handle the horses on their left side, same side we're mounting on, we lead them on that side, and they can be a little confused at first when you start to stand over onto their right side and want to either lead them or lunge them. So sometimes takes a day or two to get them just used to being handled on that side in terms of working around the person. So I will sometimes do that just in a halter on a lunge line in that round pen on a, quiet day where they're not, there's not too much distraction. The other part of that is I then tend to introduce just the saddle. I will do that usually in an open environment like a round pen. In the cross tie, sometimes just to lay the saddle on the horse's back, but I'm pretty careful about putting the girth on right away in the cross ties in case they have any reaction to that. But all things being ideal, I'll put the saddle on out in the round pen with the lunge line on and a halter, and put up the girth just enough that it's contact on their belly, but not so much that it's, tight enough to give them a little bit of that panic feel. I'll tend to walk them for a good 5-10 minutes, and during that 5-10 minutes, just tighten the girth a bit as I'm walking. And I don't tend to make the girth as tight as I would make it when I, to be on them, but I do make it pretty snug so that when I do start to lunge them again, if they do have a buck or a little bit of a scared reaction in the saddle itself isn't going to move. And then I'll tend to do the same. I'll just let them have a little trot or canter around on the lunge line and the halter for a minute, with feeling the saddle on and all of that before I get too involved with the bridle and the side reins. Next step is just to get a bridle on. That step with the saddle might, just take me a day, maybe two, to just get them acclimatized to that. Horses tend to acclimatize to that relatively quickly as long as we don't go too fast putting the girth on and getting them scared of that pressure on their back. Next up is the bridle. Usually I'll do that in the cross ties, just getting it fit to them correctly in an environment where they can't get away if they're a little funny about having the bridle put over their ears. But usually that's non-issue with them. And I tend to at first put either a lunging cavesson or a halter over the top of the bridle that I'm going to be attaching the lunge line to, whether I need a stud chain on the halter or I have the lunging cavesson on. I don't want to necessarily be pulling on the bit right away with them when I first start to lunge them. With that setup, I generally put a surcingle on over the top of the saddle when I'm ready to attach the side reins, because I tend to prefer a higher side rein, more, kind of toward the skirt of the saddle or around the knee roll or even higher up toward the pommel of the saddle versus a very low side rein, down by the horse's elbow or below where the rider's knee would be. And my feeling on that is it's a really kind of old school, classical way of setting up side reins, and that we don't need to spend a lot of time, especially as young horses, really pulling their necks down. We need to kind of spend the time teaching them to carry themselves through their own necks and kind of find a way of flexing through the pole and a real true bit acceptance. So I tend to steer away from having a really low side rein unless the horses give me reason to otherwise. And again, that's part of where taking the time comes in, because at first, if I put the side reins up a little bit higher, the horses aren't going to go round right away from that little bit of pressure. And taking a few weeks to very slowly start to introduce a little shorter and shorter side rein, that does ask the horse to flex through the pole and accept a bit pressure on its lower jaw without dropping the neck lower to try to avoid or absorb what the jaw and what the pole should be doing. With that in mind, you know, that first day I put the side reins on, I'll generally buckle them on. They tend to have a little bit of a loop in them, and I'll let the horses just have a little bit of a trot and canter around just with a little bit of the side rein kind of bouncing, not bouncing flopping big, but bouncing where it's not a strong pressure pulling on the bit. And as that day goes on and as the next few days goes on, as I'm lunging them, I'll slowly just start to tighten them up a little bit more and more. One big thing I also do is tighten the inside side rein over time, ending up being quite a bit shorter than the outside side rein. So the horses learn in that round pen to actually start to bend and flex to that inside rein pressure, which I find works very well with the round pen work itself, in that if I can get that little bit of displacement in the neck to the inside, the round pen itself generally keeps the horses from swinging their haunches out. So they learn to really stretch the outside set of muscles and contract that inside set of muscles and learn to bend before I even get on them, which makes a huge deal when it comes to being able to get on them and teach them to steer, teach them to turn and kind of bend around the leg, and teach them to be balanced. Because I find if we lunge them with the side reins absolutely straight, the horses tend to lean quite a bit to the inside, where, you know, the listeners have probably seen, if you take the side reins, have them even, horses pick up the canter, the trot, they tend to bend a little bit to the outside and lean in onto that inside shoulder, because the way the body has to lean to get the turn done, if the neck isn't allowed to kind of bend and bow to allow that alignment of the spine with the circle line that they're on. So I find teaching them to bend on the side reins or on the lunge line with the side reins tighter on the inside does a lot also for their balance at that point. And I'm usually doing a good couple of weeks of really light lunging work like that before I even bother laying over their back or putting any weight on them, because I just want them so comfortable with being handled and being worked from me and from the other person on the ground, that by the time we start to lay on their back, they're so trusting of what we're doing to them, we don't get any real kind of kickback reaction emotionally from them. One thing to really kind of be doing also is to have two people with the lunging work and the starting work, so that you can have one person standing in the middle holding the lunge line and one person following behind with the whip. I do a lot with that, with two people, so that when we do put a rider on, the horses are already used to having two people with them, so it's not emotionally more stress on them to bring a second person in that they're not used to or understanding before we even get on their backs. When it comes to kind of getting on their back, what we end up doing is once we've lunged and the horses have, you know, it worked and are a little bit on the tired side, we'll take all the equipment off the surcingle, the side reins. I generally will leave, you know, can leave the halter or the cavesson on if I'm still lunging with that versus the rein on the bit. If the horses are already transitioning to having the lunge line on the bit, then I do tend to connect right to the bit. But usually the first couple of times I'll just still have the halter, the cavesson on, because the rider isn't going to be doing anything with the reins yet. And what we usually do is just give the rider a bit of a leg up. We'll kind of tend to just stand on both sides of the saddle first and just hold the saddle, shake the saddle a little bit, bounce up and down next to them on the left and right side, and just make sure they're used to that movement on their body. Then I'll tend to kind of give the riders a leg up and just lay them over the horse's back with their belly on the saddle. Sometimes if the horses are nice and quiet with that, I might just lead them a few steps with the rider lying there. I tend to like the riders just lying on it first, just in case the horse does scoot off or do anything. It's easy for the rider to get on their feet and back on the ground and not have it turn into kind of any big issue. First couple times I tend to get a rider fully on, sitting on the horses. Like I said, I'll kind of leg them up and get them up there. And usually the first day or two, I won't even move them. We'll just stand in the middle of the round pen and get the rider on and off, sitting on the horse's back. Quite a few times, so that they're really used to that action and comfortable with it. At that point, I'll tend to start giving the rider the reins, letting them have the actual control of the horses to a degree. I'll still have a connection with them on the ground to the, you know, with the lunge line or to the bit or to the cabosun. After a few days of that, if things are good, we tend to just take them for a walk around the round pen. One or two days of just a quiet walk around the round pen, and third or fourth day, we'll basically just pick up the trot. The trot I tend to do with them, same way of lunging them. You know, I'll stand in the, hold the lunge line, have the lunge whip. Usually at this point, you know, it's kind of a non-issue because we've gone so slow. Rider's been on and off enough. They've been walked a bit with the weight of the rider on and pick up the trot a bit. I found kind of in my experience too, the horses don't get to, tend not to get too humped up in their back or too worried about that. In the trot, it is really more of the canter that they tend, if they're going to have an issue, that they tend to have an issue with. So I do like to put a couple of days of trotting in first just to make sure that the horses are nice and comfortable. And if anything happens, the rider's feeling secure and confident with that, you know, a horse underneath them. Usually about the third day, you know, give or take a couple of days, we'll ask the horse to canter. And during that whole process, I'm always saying to the rider, there's no side reins on at this point. The rider will have just enough contact to kind of mimic what the side rein was doing with their hands alone together, just basically on the pommel of the saddle, not looking or trying to get the horse on the bit, but just offering a contact and a little bit of bend, same exact kind of feel and look that they were doing on the lunge line. But when it comes to when they're being lunged with the side reins, when it comes to the actual driving aid from the rider, I tend to have my riders not do anything. I tend to still want to do all the work from the ground with my voice and with the lunge whip, since that's what the horses have been acclimatized to at this point. And we'll literally just with my voice, you know, same commands they've already learned, walk, trot, canter, down transitions and things, with that reinforcement of the lunge whip if they're not going forward. So when it comes to cantering, I'll do the same thing. I'll ask the horses from the ground to canter, and just use a little shake of the lunge whip if I need to get them to go. If they have a little bit of a hump in their back when they pick up the canter, I tend to just have the rider work to keep the horse's head up so that it doesn't turn into anything, and let them try to just keep them moving and keep them going, that they learn it's not an issue. And most of the time it really isn't. If they do tend to kind of take off or have a bit of a reaction to it, I tend to reel them in, get them back to a walk or a trot pretty quick, and just start trotting them again to let them know that they do need to keep moving, but they don't need to have that reaction. After a few days of that type of work, the horses are kind of acclimatized to doing a little bit of canter in the round pen, both directions, rider on. I'll start to have the rider transition with my voice aid to start to use their leg a little bit, or if they have a whip, they might use their whip as a little bit of reinforcement. And give that a couple of weeks where the horses are learning to transition from the voice aids to the rider's aids. And then once I feel like I can really get that established walk, trot, canter, and I'm starting to feel as the person holding the lunge line in the middle of the round pen, like my job is almost getting phased out where the rider really doesn't need me anymore. I'll start to let the horse off the lunge line with the rider, you know, after they've started on the lunge line for a few minutes, and go through that process enough times till it feels like after the horse has been lunged, we don't need to do any work with the horses on the lunge line to get them started as far as having a rider on. And I tend to be very reserved about taking the horses into big spaces, into the arena and stuff, until I feel like I have a horse that the rider could get right on after just a few minutes of lunging with no issue and no thought about, you know, any safety issues. And then what I'll usually do to transition into the larger spaces, same process, lunge them a little bit, put the rider on in the round pen, work for a few minutes in the round pen, and then just come over into the bigger space, into the arena, and then do a few minutes toward the end in the big space, and just slowly start transitioning out of round pen work and into the arena work. And I do tend to go with the policy that I like the horses really doing a good deal of canter in the round pen before I like to bring them into the dressage arena or the larger space to do their canter work, just so that I know they've learned how to balance and can be quiet about cantering in a real controlled environment. And then they usually transition pretty easy to those bigger spaces, and the straight lines then are real no-brainers because they know how to balance turns and navigate around turns. And at the same time, they've learned already through a little bit of bending work from that shorter side rein already how to bend and turn a bit, just because they've learned how to yield a touch to bit pressure, which we also tend to do a little bit in the round pen early on, just some smaller circles within the round pen circle and changes of rein, and even a very mild leg yield where I'll just have them come in the trot a few meters in off the round pen rail and let them drift back out. So they're already learning to move off the inside leg before I get them in that large space, and tend to have a nice, real easy transition with them. And I tend overall to give that process a good 3-4 months. I know other people do it quite a bit quicker. I do a good 3-4 months, sometimes even longer, before I'm really feeling like the young horses are trusting and educated enough to just go right into that large space, start working, and do all that. I go with the policy with the young ones is I just never want to let one bad day happen or one bad thing happen to them, so they never lose trust and never lose faith that they're going to be put in a position where they can't figure out or sort out what's happening to them. And I think if you go with that policy of kind of never letting a bad moment happen, they tend to come around and come along in those kind of first developmental months very quickly, very easily, and very safely.
Okay, great advice. Thank you very much indeed for that, Jeremy. And we look forward to even more tips from you in the future. So thank you for your time and coming on the show this week, Jeremy.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
And finally this week, a reminder that auditor registrations are still being accepted for the Adequan USDF FEI Level Trainers Conferences. The deadline for early online registration to attend the January 18th and 19th conference in Loxahatchee, Florida with Johan Hinneman is January the 8th. And the deadline to attend the March 14th, 15th West Coast Conference with Stephen Clark is February the 14th. Registration will be available on site at an increased price. It's 2016 now, of course, so please be sure to renew your memberships before heading out to a competition. These can be done online at usdf.org, or you can call the office directly at 859-271-2277. And whilst you're on the website, be sure to check out the USDF's Online Learning Center at eTrack for all educational information geared to dressage riders. This podcast is available for download from the iTunes podcast store to any podcast app, and you can find out more information about from the show notes attached to each of these episodes online at usdf.org. Thank you for joining us wherever you are in the world, and remember that the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.